Good afternoon. This is an interview with Dr. Richard Rohrs of the History Department of Oklahoma State University.
Hello. I'm Richard Rohrs of the Oklahoma State History Department. It's the 1st of May of 2017.
Thank you. You're welcome. Okay. So, Dr. Rohrs. Obviously, you are not originally from Oklahoma. There's no twang in your accent at all. Where are you from originally?
I was born in New York City and grew up in New York City, went to high school in New York City, and then I went to Bucknell University in Pennsylvania for my undergraduate degree, and then to the University of Nebraska for my master's and PhD. And I was fortunate enough to get hired here about a week, within a week of my graduation with my PhD.
Very fortunate. You don't hear about that very much anymore. And when did you get your PhD?
Okay, in 1976.
1976. Okay, so right at the end of the big wave of folks getting lots of jobs.
No, that's not really true. That wave ended earlier.
Oh, okay.
I always think of that wave as being over by about 1970. when I was a first semester MA student, the person who was the graduate advisor had a meeting of all the students and told us all not to continue in graduate school because the wave was over and there weren't going to be any more jobs. So I always date it, and that was in the fall of 1969. So I always think of by 69 or 70, most of that wave was over. We had people who were at OSU prior to me who had 10 job offers ABD. And it was just basically a question of where they wanted to live in the country. That the job collapse was before that, I think.
Oh, okay.
Or before I finished, I'll put it that way. So,
interesting that you held on. They tell you there's not going to be any jobs, and you held on for another 6 years. Stubborn.
Yeah. Well, my attitude about that was that I knew I couldn't get a job until I finished. Mm-hmm. You weren't going to get a job without a PhD. So to kind of, get part of the way through a PhD program and then test the job waters wasn't going to be a good kind of sense of what the job market was really like. So I kind of talked myself into finishing, trying to get a job, and then if I didn't get a job, I was going to not worry about what kind of work I did. Mm-hmm. But I was going to live in a place that I really wanted to live, so that my enjoyment would be from my non-working hours rather than from the working hours. And I was fortunate; I never had to pull the trigger on exactly plan B.
That's good. Now, I know from a previous conversation that you started out as a math major rather than history.
Yeah.
It's kind of unusual to make that kind of a change from a right brain area to a left brain field. A lot of folks don't make the shift very easily. What induced you to make that kind of a change?
Well, when I was in high school, my two favorite courses were math and history. Mm-hmm. So when I started as a freshman, as an undergraduate, I took math and had intended to be a math major. And where I was an undergraduate, the basic math course, in other words, the course that everyone had to take to fulfill the math requirement, was ten hours of calculus and analytical geometry. There was no college algebra or anything. That was the base course. Which wasn't a problem because I was good at math and I had been well prepared. The problem that I ran into, and unfortunately it's a problem that I think a lot of students even today do, is the person who taught the class did not have a great command of English. He actually was German, so it's a little bit different than what happens more frequently. So I struggled a little bit with that, and so I got, you know, I got through the 10 hours of calculus and analytical geometry, and then when I was a sophomore, I took an American, kind of a two-semester American history survey class, and I absolutely loved it. And so I'd kind of, you know, bailed out of math, primarily based on my 1 year of bad experience with the instructor, and then decided to become a history major. But I've tried to use math as much as I can in my career as an historian. I still love math. I think I've always thought a lot about why math came so easy to me, because I'm dyslexic, and you would think that math would be absolutely the worst thing for somebody who's dyslexic. And I think it's because I realized a number of years ago that I was a kinetic learner, and as opposed to a visual learner or an auditory learner. And to me, you know, then when I thought about it that way, it made absolute sense, because math is a kinetic exercise. It's, you know, going through the problems and you're physically interacting with the material rather than sitting there and reading a book. And I always kind of struggled with sitting there reading a book, but I was great at, you know, things like, you know, even physics experiments. I mean, I was really good at that too, because I could actually, physically interact with the material, and math kind of defines that. So anyway, I know that's a long answer. But
No, it's great. It actually led into the next question I had, was how has the grounding in math been helpful in your technique as a historian?
I co-authored a book with a guy in political science on the use of statistics in study of history. Mm-hmm. So that it really came as a big advantage of that. And I've done a lot of the work that I have done is integrated, I think, more tables and kind of math analysis than a typical historian would do. I've never gotten so sophisticated that I've done, you know, correlation coefficients or regressions. I've never, I've done some, but I don't know if I've actually ever integrated them into something that I've published. But I try as much as possible to integrate tables and some analysis of voting returns and things like roll call analysis, which has some mathematical elements to that. So I've tried to, because I still love math, I try to the extent that I can to integrate that into my research.
And your particular historical specialty is?
I really kind of think of myself more in a chronological period than a topical one. So I do 1787 to 1850. And I've done actually a variety of different, I've done stuff on women, on diplomatic history, political history, free blacks in the South, free blacks in the North, things involving race. So I've kind of bounced around. It's been great because as long as I kind of stay within a chronological period, I can deal with topics that are of interest to me, and I don't just do one type of thing. So it's been great, because it's forced me to learn stuff about a variety of different topical areas within that chronological framework. And it has also and kind of enabled me not to get bored. I'll follow something that sounds interesting rather than having to do, you know, variations of the same thing over and over again.
Good. You've been here 42 years, and it's coming towards the end here. How much has changed and how much is the same in the department over the in these 42 years?
Okay, the department or the university, or I mean, I'll be willing to
do both either. Actually.
Okay, I'll do them one at a time.
Sure.
When I first got here, we taught a 5-5 load, so I had 5 courses a semester. In the last 15 years or so, I've been on a 2-2 load, and when the time that I've been the graduate advisor, I'm on a 2-1 load. So one of the biggest differences is in terms of the teaching load. It's really changed, obviously. When I first got here, my annual salary was $12,000, and now I make more than that. So the pay has improved. The quality of the faculty has improved incredibly, and I think that primarily I think that's a reflection of the change in the course load. When you do 5-5, there's not too much time left to spend too much time for research. And now with the 2-2 load, the members of the department are very productive in terms of their research and scholarly output. We had a PhD and an MA program when I got here, so in terms of the nature of the graduate programs, I don't think has changed significantly. This is the third building I've been in. So the history department has moved 3 times since I've gotten here, I guess twice, but 3 different locations. So the physical space that we have is infinitely better. The financial support for travel, research is infinitely better. The kind of academic exchange and interaction between members of the department is infinitely better. And I think, again, that some of that at least is a reflection of the teaching load. There has been, in the last couple of years, there's in the graduate program, there has been a movement. When I first got here, at least in American history, we thought primarily in terms of chronological periods. Mm-hmm. So we had people who covered chronological periods, and we didn't do a whole lot thematically or topically within American history. And now that has changed in the last few years a lot, and I think that just mirrors what's changing in the profession nationally. I think people not everybody needs to have somebody who can teach the Progressive Era. So I think a lot of times people are more interested in having people who can deal with things like gender or race or immigration, border. There's all kinds of different things. So that's a change that's happened here, but it's also happened nationally. In terms of the university, when I first got here, the history department was perceived of as a service department. In other words, that in terms of the upper administration, the role of the history department was to teach the American History Survey, because that was a requirement of all students. Everybody had to take one semester of American history. So we got virtually no recognition. There wasn't much support from the upper administration. And the humanities in general, I think, were considered or perceived of as kind of, second-class citizens or maybe even third-class citizens. If you weren't in engineering or ag, mm-hmm. or some kind of a science discipline that could support engineering or ag, the upper administration was not particularly interested. So that's really changed. I mean, I think now, even with the irony of that is we had a PhD program and they still thought of us that way. But now I think we do get a fair amount of recognition. We're no longer, I think OSU has changed and become much more of a comprehensive university
than it was when I got here. And the history department and what role we can play in the comprehensive university, I think, is really recognized much more so than it ever was when I first got here. And the financial support, and it's just not, you know, it's not just financial support, it's just, it can be recognition in any form, it doesn't have to be financial, I think has really improved a lot. The students are different. There was an intermediate time between when I first got here and now when I thought the students were significantly better. And I think there's been a little bit of erosion of that, but I don't think it's based on their ability. I think it's more based on their motivation. When I first got here, I used to occasionally get students who I thought were functionally illiterate, who really couldn't read, or if they could read, they really struggled. I don't get students like that anymore. So I think the students are smarter. They may be better prepared, but they have less motivation. They're not as well motivated. Sometimes the people who really struggled to read were really motivated to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a lot of students now who don't, who are not particularly well motivated.
Very diplomatically put. Do you have any thoughts on where this sea change in motivation of the students? What could be behind it?
No, not I don't have any personal sort of just things that, you know, that a lot of people have said about the various generations that have come to school in the last 20 years. You know, helicopter parents and being spoiled. You know, people who are used to spending a lot of time by themselves in front of computers or on their phone or laptops. And so I don't know. I've never understood. So I don't have any insight, any better insight than, you know, what pundits have said nationally about what some of the problems may have been.
Okay. Let's see. Oh, you said the overall recognition from the university has improved in over these years. Do you think that it was because of a change in emphasis from the management's viewpoint, or is it something the department has done to make itself stand out more?
Well, I think it's both. I think a lot of it is from the administration. In other words, the administration doesn't have that perception of that this is an agricultural and mechanical school and does nothing else. And I think there have been, when I first got here, it was like, you know, virtually every president and every provost was either from agriculture or engineering. And we've actually had a string now of provosts in particular that have been in arts and sciences. Not all of them, but many of them have been in arts and sciences. And I think that they have a broader sense of what a university is. And I think President Hargis has done well to just kind of turn over the day-to-day operation of the academic side of the university to the provost. And he has not, at least as far as I can tell, interfered in that. And we've had presidents in the past who have done that. So so that has been a problem in the past. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't answer the other half. The other thing is, I think the department, I'm sorry, I forgot, that department heads differ. They're, and we've had a number of department heads, particularly in the last 15 years or so, who I think have been really good about nominating people for either college or university awards. That's not something that department heads necessarily have to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's an added thing that they do, but we've had a number of department heads who have been really good about doing that. And if you don't get nominated, you can't win anything. So that's the kind of the other side of it. It's the university respecting the humanities and the value of the humanities more, but also the department heads being willing to nominate people, and then also having people in your department who are worthy of being recognized, you know, in terms of their quality, either in terms of their research or their teaching or service or something. So it's kind of a three-way thing.
Going back to something you said earlier, you were talking about when you first came aboard, it was a 5-5 plan. Was that for all the professors or just the junior most?
My sense is that most everybody was teaching either 4-4 or 5-5. I don't know everybody's teaching load. It's not something that's shared. I mean, it's kind of an agreement between the department head and the individual faculty member. There's nothing posted, and I typically don't go through the class schedule to see what everybody's teaching. I don't now, and I didn't then, but my general sense is that everybody was either doing a 4-4 or 5-5. The first year I was here, I was actually a visiting assistant professor. So I don't know if I was at a 5-5 because I was a visitor and everybody else was at a 4-4, but I don't think I had a significantly different load than everybody else. With the exception of maybe the graduate advisor, the department head, the undergraduate advisors, those people I'm sure had some kind of course release.
Of a five semester, five class semester, typically how many would be undergraduate classes and how many would be graduate seminars?
The first year I was here, I only taught undergraduate classes. My memory, I don't remember. I'm trying to remember how the undergraduate, I've never, ironically, in 42 years, ever taught a research seminar, ever.
Wow, okay.
So I've never done one of those. I can't tell you exactly at what point I started to teach reading seminars, because we've restructured them so many times.
Mm-hmm.
I know I taught them in the 90s, and I'm sure I taught them in the 80s. The one course that I started to teach pretty routinely in the graduate program was the methods course. And I always kind of thought I started teaching that in the mid-80s, maybe 85 or 86 or something like that. But I recently shredded a whole bunch of grade books, and I think I found a grade book that had me teaching that in 1980. I can't believe that, but that's what it said. I didn't think it was that early. So, I mean, that would be, so the reality is that there was overwhelmingly undergraduates. And at that time, the American History Survey classes, it was before we went to 1103, we were still doing the two halves, 1483 and 1493.
Mm-hmm.
And so the class size was smaller. Those were usually, I think, either 75 or 85. So we obviously had a lot of sections.
Mm-hmm.
So it, you know, it may have been the first several years I was here that I may have done two or three sections of 1483 and or 1493. Sometimes I did some of both. So that would have eaten up a lot of my hours in terms mm-hmm. of my responsibilities. And then and I can't remember exactly what the year is. I would say in the late 70s or early 80s, I was one of the people who really pushed for going to a one semester American History Survey class, which we did. The argument that I always tried to make was it was required that everybody had take one every undergraduate had to take one semester of American history. And so we were graduating these people who either knew a little bit about 1865 or 1877 or since 1865 or since 1877. And I thought that that was really a disservice, and made the argument if we were only going to get them one semester, and we had very few who came, who took the other half. Mm-hmm. If we were only going to have them for one semester, why not give them an overview of all American history? It made a lot more sense to me. For better or for worse, we've been doing that ever since then. And that was, I would say maybe 80, 81, something like that was when we made that transition. We still offer a few sections of both halves, primarily for the people in the College of Education who, social studies education, I think, requires that they take both halves.
Yes, I had to. I was gonna ask about that. When I was an undergrad, Dr. Smith was teaching it. Did you ever take a turn with the secondary ed social studies?
Yeah, in fact, I taught it last fall.
Oh.
I've taught it at other times, but I think the other times I've taught it have been like in the summer,
mm-hmm.
or in a short course. So I think once we made the transition to 1103, I think I basically stopped teaching those sections of 83 and 93, except for last fall when I taught 83 and some non-traditional formatted classes, like summer school, that mm-hmm. kind of stuff.
When you came in, was there the rule still in place that it is now for tenure, you had to publish?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Same.
The expectations were less, again, because we were doing so much teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you, I don't remember exactly what they were in terms of the expectations. I don't think we had a numerical value the way that we do now. I think it was more something was maybe worded a little bit more generally and said that, you know, some indication of scholarly output or proof, you know. I don't remember there being and then we kind of that was the initial way, and then we transitioned to three articles in peer review national or international journals or a book. And then more recently, we transitioned to GAN, and we kind of jacked that up. And I think now it's four articles. So what we tried to do is kind of redefine that as the teaching load went down.
I see.
So there has, but I'm unfortunately, I just can't remember what the original one was. My guess is there was not as numerically specific as three. Mm-hmm. articles or a book or four articles or a book like we have it now.
So it would be more in the judgment of the committee whether you had done enough?
Yeah, and I think at that point they were just, you know, that they were looking for some output. If you could demonstrate that you were involved, you know, you were capable of publishing the results of your research and you had some output, I think that would be enough. It was a different time. Mm-hmm. It was a different attitude and part of the administration, and with teaching as much as we did, and different number of different preps.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, a number of years ago, I had counted up how many different courses I taught, and it was well over 20 or 25, and that was a long time ago. I've actually taught other courses since then. So when you have that much prep time, even you can make the argument that three sections of 75 is one section of 225, but it still takes a lot of time to go to class and minister. You know, I don't remember. I'm sure I had some TAs, but I don't remember a ton of TA help. So some of that stuff, I was doing a lot of the grading. You know, just going to class twice a week, let's say Tuesday, Thursday at 10 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
or going, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and teach three sections of 75, even though it's the same number of students, you know, in terms of a prep and physically walking back and forth to class and classes you spend, time you spend in class and administering those classes. It's really not the equivalent, even though the number of students that are served is the equivalent.
I see. How many books have you published, if may I ask?
Well, kind of, I guess one and a half. I had an opportunity right after I got here to be part of a big grant that the Oklahoma Department of Libraries got on looking at ethnic groups in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
So I had done some work in graduate school with the guy, one of the people, well, maybe the person in the United States who had dealt with German immigrants. So as a result of that, I was one of the 10 people selected. So I did the book for, it's called Oklahoma Image. This is a long answer, but I'll tell you why in a minute.
Okay.
So the Oklahoma Image series, and Dr. Mike Smith did one on Mexicans,
mm-hmm.
and there were a couple of other people in the department. There was a separate book on Germans from Russia, which had a radically different experience. So I got an opportunity to do that. Now, why I kind of hedge a little bit is it's about 100 pages or 85 pages, something like that. So I always hate to call it a book, but it's more substantive than an article. So I don't know if you call it a booklet. So I always say kind of one and a half. And then more recently I did that book on kind of using quantitative methods for the study of history, which I co-authored with a guy in political science.
So one and a half on books. How many would you say you've? How many articles would you say you've authored or co-authored?
I don't know. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 16 or 17. It's close. I've never sat down and counted the books. The books are easy to count. The articles. The articles I don't count.
Okay.
I mean I count them, but I don't literally count. I'm proud of them. I'm glad I did them, but I don't keep a running total written on my hand about how many I've done.
So never come in the office, pull up the CV, and go 1, 2, 3, 4.
No, I've never done that. I'm sorry. I'm sure I did that when I had a couple and I was coming up for tenure. Then I probably counted them, but not in a long time. I'll put it that way.
You were talking about department heads. Have you ever been department head?
Yeah, I was department head, and I can't tell you exactly what the years were, but something like 1988 to 1990 for 2 years. At that time, we didn't have a set term.
Mm-hmm.
We do now. Basically, department's been kind of formalized. Department heads are serve in 3-year terms, but I did it for 2 years in the late 80s.
Without getting too specific, what all is involved with being department head, if I might add? I said without going into any areas and getting
into
trouble.
It's an interesting job. I once had an opportunity at a cocktail party to talk to the guy who at the time was the president of OSU, and he had been a department head, a dean, a provost, and a president of a university. So he had held all the administrative posts going up. And he said he thought that by far and away the worst job was being department head. And it's an odd job because you get pressured from kind of below and above. my experience, I think the most surprising, there were two surprising things. I think everybody who gets that job is surprised by what it entails, because I don't think anybody could tell you and explain to you what it's going to be like. So the one thing is that you you find yourself in a position where you get a lot of people, the people in the department who come to see you for personal problems. So there were times in which I felt like, you know, a marriage counselor, a priest, a psychiatrist, a mother figure, father figure, just, you know, every conceivable role that you can think of, because people would come in and I guess, you know, they come in, they close the door and they start to talk, and that really surprised me. And it's an odd, I tried to tell department heads since I did it that was going to happen to them, and they always look at me like, no, that's not going to happen, and I'm sure it always does. But there's you know, confessor, just all kinds of things. The other thing that really surprised me, and ultimately why I didn't enjoy it, that part I didn't mind, and I didn't mind the kind of the administration of the department. What I really disliked was the interaction with above, and it wasn't so much who the dean was or the associate deans or the provost. It wasn't so much the personality of those individuals, rather than I guess what administration of a big organization is like, because there were so many times that, you know, I'd get a phone call. This was pre-email. Get a phone call and email or phone call, and somebody would say, we need to know, you know, how many people that you have in the departmental majors who have orange hair and who are right-handed and are going to graduate in 2 years. So this, you know, a little report on some kind of very specific thing, and we need it in an hour. So you run around and you try to get this information, and you know, you get it, you send it up the chain, you know, in 59 minutes, and you never ever hear. You never see it in a report. You never get a sense of how that information even was used or was necessary to collect. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, 2 hours later, there would be. We do the same thing with people who had green hair and were left-handed. So there's this constant kind of dumping or request for information from above that just goes out there and just, you know. And that part was very frustrating. I'm a kind of person who likes to be, I won't say I'm organized, but I like to kind of plan my day, things that are like plan a week, plan something, and so I don't like getting interrupted. So there's constant requests for silly things. That got to me. I didn't enjoy that part.
I see.
So, but it was interesting. I'm glad I did it. You know, I think there are some people who should never be department head, and there are other people who should take their turn, and I didn't have any problem taking my turn.
You brought up a point a moment ago when you talked about whether or not email was around yet. Now, I'm assuming when you came on board in 76, the computers were a little more rare in the department?
Oh, none. There were none. Far as I know, there was one computer on campus, and it was a big, big IBM that was in the basement of Mass Sciences. There were no computers. I know a little bit about that technological change because, as it turned out, I was involved in most of that. Just, I think, by chance, it wasn't that I was any great insight. We had a department head who started in, I guess, in maybe the fall of 79, and he was department head for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. And I think he realized or anticipated that some kind of word processing would be beneficial. So he actually bought or leased one of the first kind of word processing stations that I had ever seen. And so we had one or two of those in the main office, and but they were gigantic, and I don't even remember how that worked with the memory. I think they had these really big, they were like, I don't know, 4x4, 6x6 floppies, but they were gigantic, and they were literally floppy. they had no structure to them, or not much structure. So we had two of those, and so I did some work on those. It wasn't my decision to buy them. It was his decision, but he and I went over to Tulsa. I'll never forget this, on Thanksgiving Day,
uh-huh.
one time, because the people who were trying to sell it to us were willing to have us go over there and use the ones that they had for a project that he was working on. So he and I went over there on Thanksgiving Day and to borrow. And again, I think it was for them, it was the sales, you know, it was the sale. So if they thought they could make us happy. So, and I did quite a bit of work on that. I thought it was a good deal. And then when I was department head, I bought everybody in the department a computer, a PC. And so in that sense, I was the first person to do that. So I gave everybody one so that they could have it on their desk. And that was kind of odd because most people didn't own one. They had some of the faculty members had never seen one. So I made them all go to computer school. And that was some of the most humorous and also most pathetic days in my life were watching them go to computer school. Because I remember one faculty member who we had been in the first day, we'd been in there for about a half an hour and people were beginning to get the sense of typing and everything. And they raised their hand and said, how do you turn this on? I'm not trying to be a pioneer, saying claim that I was a pioneer, but I was the person who spent the money to put one on everybody's desk, and ever since then we've always had one. And now we don't have to pay for them. The university or the college, somebody pays for them, and every 5 years we get a new one.
AXA was letting us know that there was going to be some new ones available this summer.
No good. Well, I'm sure somebody's going to get mine. And I think they'll buy new ones for the new people who will come in. So I'm sure mine's going to be more. Mine's only about 18 months old, I think.
Let's see. I'm interested in your philosophy about whether the information revolution as far as communication with has actually increased or decreased the amount of effective communication that's going on. The constant flow of emails, text messaging.
I think it's horrible. I virtually never have students come to my office hours. And before I used to have a lot of people come in, and what they do now is I don't give out my phone number, so I don't get text messages from students, but I certainly get a lot of email from students. And in a sense, it's, you know, it's convenient, but I kind of miss that one-to-one contact that I had with students in the past when that wasn't an option. If they had a problem, or if they needed to see me, or if they wanted to clarify an assignment, they wanted help, whatever, they had to come see me. And I very rarely see students outside of class. So I think that in that sense, it's been a negative. But it is, you know, it's convenient. I will say that, you know, and I've kind of thought about this, and I've never sat down and tried to quantify it, but I may hear from more students in an average class because of email than I would if they had to come to my office. So even though the quality may be worse, the quantity is probably better because they have no problem emailing about anything at any time of day. Usually I always try to look at when the emails have arrived, and they're so often they're, you know, 3 a.m., 3:29, 12:30, I keep saying you guys should be asleep.
Yeah, I can see that. All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Roars. This has been very helpful. I wish you the best of luck with whatever you decide to do after this.
Well, thanks, Jack. Best of luck to you, too. Oh, I think you'll be fine, Jack. You're going to be okay.
That's really good to hear.